This episode of The Imposter is sponsored by Second City, which is the largest school for improv and sketch comedy in the world. Their training center has almost every kind of class you can think of, from amateur to pro, whether you're looking for an intensive or a 7-week journey, or a way to manage your anxiety. So if you want to give it a try, you can get a free drop-in class by going to secondcity.com/CanadaLand. This episode is also sponsored by Endy, the online mattress company that's Canadian-made, which is relevant not because of patriotism, but because I love good value. Since they manufacture locally, Endy avoids duties, currency exchanges, and international shipping, which means that even a California king-size mattress, those ones that are so big that you can sleep across them, those cost less than $1,000. To get $50 off any mattress, go to endy.ca, promo code IMPOSTER. From Canada Land, this is The Imposter, and I'm Aliyah Pabani. So, I've been trying to become a comedian since September. I rewatched The Party, this 1968 comedy where Peter Sellers does brownface, to try and figure out why it was so funny, and then I asked my dad why he introduced me to it.
I was just totally convinced, like everybody else that's seen the movie since, that Peter Sellers was actually a brown person.
I got into a bit of a standoff with my comedy instructor about fat jokes.
You're not the only one that struggles with this because they get upset about the topic of overweight, and it's very politically incorrect to make fun of fat people, right?
And then I did my first 5-minute set on a stage in front of a real live audience.
When I was growing up, the white kids used to call me a black piece of shit, which is confusing because shit is brown.
I was on a bit of a tip. I started going to see more comedy, live performances, stuff on Netflix. I watched a lot of things that I didn't even find funny so that I could figure out why it wasn't working for me. I found myself going to see this one comedian, Chris Locke, again and again. But I couldn't really put my finger on what it was about him.
Hi, I'm Chris Locke, and I love the sun.
I'm not religious, but I still think God is watching me every second and I ask him for help all the time. What's that all about? Like, people are like, are you religious? I'm like, fuck no, that's an old fairy tale. It's so stupid, but
can you help me? I'm in trouble. Watch over me.
With a lot of comedians, it can be kind of disappointing to see them a bunch of times because it can feel like a bit of a rerun. But I saw Chris do 3 shows in 4 months. And even though I could recognize the traces of something that I'd seen earlier, he would break the premise open and riff on it in new ways every time. He's got this bit about going to therapy.
But I do go to therapy, so don't worry. I know some of you are watching, and some of you are not watching. I don't know why I said that. You're all watching? Are you guys all watching? Me? Thank you.
But for Chris, the standard going to my therapist bit is just the scaffolding. This is how it usually starts.
Does anyone go to therapy? Woo! That's what I love. See, that's the reaction. We live in a nice, chill, progressive city. It's very nice. Because I was in a club in Calgary recently. I really hated it. Because I'd be like, does anyone here do, does anyone here to go to therapy or whatever? And they were just like, and it was like, all the air got sucked out of the room. Like, take their cowboy hat off of their head and shove it into their ass. And they'd be like, like, toot, toot, you know, and then like, they'd be like, therapy, you're gay!
But he takes it in a slightly different direction every time.
Just to, like, go to therapy, but when you go, don't go after you've just eaten a huge Indian roti. Because then he just clomped down on her couch and she's like, so how are we? And you're like, I want to kill myself, you know? And then she's like, cha-ching, making money. Just an aside, is it normal for your therapist to say this all the time? Are you yanking my chain? Is it normal for me to say this every time I leave? Love you, mommy. I laughed while I was saying that one.
This one's from a different show, and it also starts with eating a roti before therapy. But then it turns into this kind of fever dream. Chris ends up bopping around the stage like a cartoon character from the 90s.
But here's my thing for therapy. When you go, don't go after you've just eaten a huge Indian roti. You know what I mean? Because then you just plop down on the couch and then she's like, how are we today? And you're like, I want to kill myself, you know? And then she's like, cha-ching, making money, making money. And, so I got a cool therapist. When I come in and see her, I kick the door open. I'm like, I'm here. And then we go, woo, boom, boom. We bounce butts. I'm like, me and Julio down by the schoolyard, you know. Pew! And then my therapist is kind of small, so she's like, and like falls into a garbage can. And then I help her. And I'm like, I'm just kidding. And I'm like, come on, now, let's get it going. Now fix this fucking thing. I wrote that joke, I swear. That's written down on paper.
A lot of stand-up is kind of procedural. It's about whittling your material down over the course of several shows or switching a word out for another one or waiting an extra couple of beats before you deliver the blow line. And Chris does some of that, sure. But he's also finding new ideas on stage instead of just figuring out the best way to deliver them. That's improv.
It's ingrained in my acting and my stand-up now. Like, when you go to see me do stand-up, yes, I do a ton of written jokes, but the show is never the same. In fact, I can never really be one of those stand-up comedians that just sticks to the script because I've had so much freedom on stage, and I love the thrill of discovering in the moment. And even stand-ups that don't do improv courses, when they go on the road over and over again, they start learning who their voice is on stage when you get like a rowdy crowd or you get a heckler or something unique happens in the moment and they have to riff on it and make jokes. Like, but I would say if you do the improv first and then go on stand up, it's even tighter and you can take it to even wilder places, maybe, you know?
Chris started out in comedy the way a lot of people do, but the comedy he was seeing at open mics was a bit dark. Like, we all know what open mics are like, right? He was looking for more of a silly vibe than a depressing one, so he started doing improv at Second City. Okay, and I should say here that this isn't something that I have to mention because they're giving us money. A lot of the more experimental comedians I've met passed through Second City at some point. Chris wanted to make work that used the structure of mainstream comedy to get somewhere more surreal, but he still swears by the fundamentals he picked up in those Second City improv classes.
One thing that I really remember from improv classes that helped me a lot in all of my comedy is not trying to be funny, but being true to how you would respond in the real instance. If you start an improv scene and you just literally find how you would communicate with the other person, realistically, the humor will be richer.
So I might be new to comedy, but I'm not new to performance. I've played a Joy Behar-style character in a dark sci-fi talk show, and I've dragged 50 feet of extension cord through a packed audience while a drone version of Enya's Echoes and Rain played in the background. The thing I really love about it is the part where you're kind of vulnerable to the elements. The audience reaction, a prop that's not working the way it was supposed to. Those are the things that force you to invent something in the moment. I know that there are a lot of ways to be a good comedian, but there's something kind of constraining about the way that involves sitting down and writing out jokes on a Google Doc and then delivering them more or less the same way on stage. I wanted to get to those wilder places that Chris was talking about. So I did an 18-hour intensive improv class at Second City. And after the break, you'll hear how it went. This episode of The Imposter is sponsored by Second City, which is a world-famous improv and sketch comedy enterprise that started in Chicago in 1959. And ever since then, it's been spitting out comedy geniuses like John Candy, Amy Poehler, and Tina Fey. Second City Toronto is continuing the tradition of introducing new generations of comedic talent to the world with their 81st review, The Best Is Yet to Come Undone, which opens on March 27th. This year, they've added three new faces, and if you don't know about them, you should. Sharjil Rasool was part of the JFL New Faces Showcase in 2016, and he's a member of the award-winning improv troupe Mantown. Chris Wilson is half of the decorated sketch duo Peter and Chris, where I assume he's Chris. He's contributed to College Humor, CBC's Irrelevant Show, and Royal Canadian Air Farce. And Stacey McGonigal returns to the main stage after winning Best Supporting Actress at the Austin Film Fest for her role in Must Kill Carl, and playing the lead in NBC's comedy pilot, Ellen More or Less, which Variety called the breakout of pilot season. Get tickets for Second City's 81st review, The Best Is Yet to Come, at secondcity.com. And if you want to know if you've got what it takes, you can get a free drop-in improv class at the training center by going to secondcity.com/CanadaLand. This episode of The Imposter is also sponsored by Endy, the Canadian-made online mattress company. When Endy offered me a mattress to try out, I gave it to my friend Gina because she just moved to Vancouver, and when she still lived in Toronto, she used to make me food that tasted so good that I would be moved to tears. Last episode, Gina and her partner Mick had just gotten the mattress delivered, and then I called them the next morning to find out how their sleep went. Here's Mick.
When I got into the bed, we like put the sheets on, and then I said, Gina, it feels like the bed is hugging my butt. It's perfect.
I wanted to know how perfect, so I asked them to compare their new Endy queen-size mattress to their old mattress, which was given to them by Mick's parents' friend Janice. There were two categories.
I don't know. Looks.
Well, the old mattress is covered with inexplicable stains.
Okay, so how about comfort?
The old mattress did not hug my butt. This one does. I'm a front sleeper, so if it's not firm enough, it's really bad for my back.
I like the feeling of memory foam. Like, it has, like, a pretty unique way of feeling under your body. It's, like, kind of heavy and dense, but soft at the same time.
Endy actually makes their own kind of memory foam that's made of millions of microscopic air cells for comfort. They've got a 100-day return policy, and if you want to try an Endy mattress, you can get $50 off any of them by going to endy.ca, that's E-N-D-Y.ca, and entering the promo code IMPOSTER at checkout. Okay, I want you to hear what happened. But since I wasn't actually allowed to record the class, I got a group of improvisers to improvise my improv class. What you're about to hear is Becky Johnson, Anne Pornell, Alia Rasool, and Kayla Lorette recreating exactly what happened in class. But they took some liberties. They're playing characters based on a few of my actual classmates, and not to blow your mind, but even though they're all women, some of them are playing characters who are not women. Here we go.
Kunja, Kunja, Kunja. Bunny, 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 bunny. Bunny, 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 bunny.
Bunny, 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 bunny.
Bunny, bunny, bunny,
bunny. Bunny, 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 bunny.
Bunny, 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 bunny.
Bunny, 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 bunny.
Zip, zap, zop, zip, zap, zop,
zip, zap, zop,
zip, zap, zop,
zip, zap, zop,
zip, zap, zop,
zip, zap, zop,
zip, zap, zop,
zip, zap, zop.
What are, what's Danny's motivation?
Danny doesn't understand
eyeliner
the exercise.
If he does anything vaguely performative, he has to look around for approval from everyone else, like, huh? And didn't come to every session, gets high in the breaks.
When scenes end and stuff, she'll be like, good, good, good.
Phyllis Diller?
Yeah, maybe it's like a Phyllis Diller situation.
Don't know who this Timothée is. Phyllis Diller is like...
Let's do a classic, just clap, focus, baby. Oh my God, okay.
Danny in.
Great.
I love fruit.
Yes!
Vitamins. Yes.
I love fuzzy socks.
Yay! Okay.
I love world peace.
Oh, yeah. That's so nice.
Yeah. I love my weekly fast day.
Yeah!
All right.
Okay.
I love my stock portfolio.
Okay, oh, businessman. Yeah.
Okay, I love cabaret.
Yeah.
I love like beautiful eyeliner.
Oh,
with
whoa, you wear eyeliner! Hey, no way! Yeah! Yeah!
Is he allowed to do that? Because it feels like not.
How about this? We're just gonna, the whole point of the exercise, we're just saying yes to everything.
We're just
okay?
Yes.
We're celebrating.
Yeah,
so
but
cheering.
Like Kale.
Listen, improv has no judgment, right? In this room, we're safe. We have no judgment for
feels
each
like
other.
There's judgment. So
okay,
I'm just clocking how I feel.
We'll just keep going.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll support
I
you.
I love dance.
Yes!
Yes, we do.
Maybe that sounded fun to you. I mean, it was definitely fun to reenact it, but it was hard for me to get through that first class. Most of the games were fine, but things kind of shifted for me when we got to what I call the affirmation game. It's like, okay, we're playing a game where people just list things that they love, and then you clap. If they say they love their stock portfolios or that they love Israel, your job is just to clap. But then this guy responds in a way that's pretty homophobic, and it breaks the game. And I mean, that's the problem with affirmation when you don't have a shared set of values. You make space for everything. I went into improv because I needed to get out of my head a little bit, but it felt like there was this pressure to be on the same wavelength as everyone else. Instead of getting out of my head, I became extremely critical and judgmental. If someone did a gesture that seemed inspired by go-go dancing, I would think, bit of a cliche. It felt like I was being inoculated into something that I wasn't totally sold on. And maybe that's also what makes improv a great tool for corporate management. There's this essential 1979 book by the theater guru Keith Johnston. It's called Improvisation in the Theater. He introduces this concept of over-accepting, or that yes-and philosophy that's at the core of improv. It's the idea that the best improvisers roll with everything their team members offer up. It's about building on the premise and resisting the urge to steer things your way. Johnston says that the goal is to get actors to a state where their individual personalities are disrupted and they feel what he calls a sense of decisionlessness. It's critical reading for improvisers. It's also on the required reading list for employees of Peter Thiel's multi-billion dollar CIA-funded data analysis company, Palantir Technologies. But the idea of improv as a tool for corporate yes-manning doesn't really square with my experience of the people who actually do improv outside of the boardroom. For Misha Globerman, it all began with improv. Misha teaches communication and negotiation skills in a course called How to Talk to People About Things. He founded a school called the Misha Globerman School of Learning, where he got people to stand in a circle and improvise nonverbal sounds together. And back when he was in college at Harvard, he started an improv troupe after he got rejected from the mainstream one. And it's still going today.
We had really strict, strong, like aesthetic rules and feelings about the right and wrong way to do improv, which I think don't survive at all. And what survives is like the name, which is called the immediate gratification players. And the other thing that I think survives is I don't know if this is still true, but last time I checked, it was sort of in like the way a university group will have a kind of mythology. Mm-hmm. They sort of have this mythological character who is the founder of their group, who is named Misha Globerman. But I don't think that mythological character has anything in common with me, apart from the fact that he, you know, it's my name and he formed the immediate
gratification. Is there like a framed gilded photo with like a wreath around it that they perform under?
Or? Yeah, well, there's a picture of me, of course. Yeah. But we had, even when I was there, we had that. I mean, okay. That goes without saying.
But so how did you start it?
I'd done improv in Montreal with a group called Theater Schmieder. They were like super cool. They were like incredibly cool. Like it was sort of like, it's like in the 80s, they were like in a loft and they had like, you know, it was sort of like adjacent to like the punk scene. Their stuff was really political and they did like, you know, it's like they were downtown artists and they were a bunch of downtown artists. And what these downtown artists were doing was like this improv stuff. And they mm-hmm. had like, you know, they had like posters they put around town that had this sort of like edgy cut and paste art that would like, that was like zine sort of aesthetic art yeah. and stuff. Like it was, yeah, it didn't have like, anyway, it wasn't the sort of culture I associate with improv now. And it seemed very cool to me. And they were like probably in their early 20s and I was 17. So they were like grown up, amazing people in the city. And I was like a kid. I was completely in awe of them. And I loved doing the improv. I loved the work. And then I went off and I did that. I think I'd probably just been doing that for like a year or two. But when you're 17, that's a long time. And then when I went off to college, I went and there was one improv group at school and I auditioned for it and I didn't get called. And one of the ways in which the improv stuff was very adjacent to punk culture was there was this very super duper DIY kind of thing. Like the idea was like, just start your own band, like just start your own zine. Like a big part of it was just like, anyone can do this stuff. Like just get up on stage and do it. So I think that had been so sort of taught into me in the improv stuff that I did that there wasn't any part of me that thought like, well, I can't start. I was like, yeah, sure. I'll start my own improv group. You know, right. It'd be great. So
that's wild to me that like you're kind of making comparisons. Like punk culture is something that I really strongly associate with like refusal, and I feel like right. improv is very supportive and about like building and saying yes and collaborating.
Yeah, but I guess it's the part of punk culture that like there was this thing that was in this zine that's this picture that was like here's a chord, here's another chord, now go start a band. Like that's a very supportive, positive, like right. go out there and be creative kind
it's
of message.
It's not about like learning something kind of within an institution.
Yeah, or about the idea that you have to earn the right to be on stage or about, and also the part of punk that I think, and of zine culture, that I think is really harder to remember like in the age of the internet, which is that the idea that you were like just by taking the means of cultural production on, you were doing something sort of rebellious, especially if you did it in a way, if you were someone who seemed not to quite deserve it. So the same way that like punk musicians like prided themselves on being like, I just learned to play the guitar a month ago and now I'm in a band and screw mm-hmm. you. Like there was something about pushing down at those kinds of walls, which I think was also for us very present in improv too. Like part of the idea was like, yeah, we just, you know, people just get on stage. They don't have a script. We've been doing this for a month and it's going to be great. It's not going to be like all the polished stuff you see on television. So in that sense, I shared a lot with punk.
Mm-hmm. Do you, like, what is it about improv? Like, what is it that was the kind of core of it that you were attracted to, other than the fact that it was kind of adjacent to this, like, subculture?
There's this thing I always sort of think of as, like, the improv feeling. That's, like, what to me it feels like when you're doing improv and it feels really good, which is that you kind of lose yourself in it. And there's something kind of amazing. And we did a lot of games. Like, in that group, we did a lot of games that were really these specific games that were about like shared control and loss of control and stuff like that. So we did lots of games where like you would talk in a nonsense language and someone else off stage would translate your words for you, mm-hmm. you know? And so you're being this person and you're talking, you're bringing a lot to it, but you're not actually choosing the words that come out of your mouth. And you play a game like that. And the thing that'd be amazing is you'd come out of that game and you'd be like, oh yeah, I remember when I said blah, blah, blah. But it's like, oh, you didn't say that. Like someone else said that. And I think that was like ultimately the thing that stuck with me like for years as a thing to be interested in about improv, is like what it can be like for a group of humans to like do something together where control is really, really, really distributed in these weird ways, and both what it looks like from the outside and also what it feels like from the inside to be doing that.
Do you like connect that kind of core feeling or that thought or that idea to like what you do now in teaching people to negotiate and communicate with each other?
Yeah, it's different experientially, but the idea is the same, which is that I think the principal thing that people need to learn to be good in a very wide range of situations, including negotiation and collaboration and all kinds of things like that, is that the inclination to try to unilaterally control the outcome is generally a poor inclination. that it doesn't work well. And that's very similar to improv, right? So in improv, what you have to do is like give up that desire to be able to control the situation. And I think that's true in collaborations, and it's true in negotiations too, that if you go in just sort of being like, I know where I want this thing to go and I'm going to try to drive it that way, it's not going to work. And the main reason it's not going to work is because all the parties are going to be doing that. And so you just can't get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes it work is being able to give up control and share control and be less unilateral and less controlling. So in that way, it's very, very, very similar.
Mm-hmm. I guess the reason why I'm interested in this question more broadly is that, like, the thing that I initially just really hated about it
mm-hmm.
was the idea that it seemed to be so much about, like, affirmation, and it seemed like there wasn't really a lot of space for, like, refusal.
Right.
Like, I found that really grating, and it kind of made me feel, like, powerless in the end, which I felt like wasn't the intended effect.
Right.
So, like, the first class, there was a moment where an audience was set up and everybody had to go up, and for 2 minutes, two timed minutes, they just had to say everything that they loved, like
right.
kind of stream of consciousness. I love my computer. I love podcasting. I love, you know, the shirt I'm wearing.
Right.
And then for that entire time, like the rest of the audience just had to clap like right. continuously for everything that they liked.
Yeah.
But it felt like a lot of people were kind of like coming out of their shell and like having the experience of being affirmed. And that felt like really good for people,
yeah.
is what I observed.
Yeah.
And I felt like...
It's funny because in the workshops that I did, we did lots of games that were also about that kind of appreciation stuff. But usually there was something in it that gave it more of a twist that made it less just kind of feeling like you were like being made to smile when you didn't feel happy, which is kind of what it sounds like your experience of that was. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we did,
and also
yeah.
clapping is actually physically demanding.
Yeah,
I find people don't realize how physically demanding. Or maybe
no one appreciates it. All the clappers, no one thanks them. Who claps for the clappers?
yeah, I think the reason why it didn't necessarily have those dimensions was because people were coming in there like a lot of people shy about performance, and
yeah.
but the thing is, like, I've done performance, and so I'm not like shy about it. I don't know. It just kind of felt like I was in the little kid class or something.
There's a part of me where all the things that you're saying are things. I'll go to the other side of it. So there's part of me that all the things that you're saying where I like agree with you completely. And there's also part of what you're saying where I kind of disagree with you. Or not disagree with you, but like just like would want to suggest a different way to think about it. Which is that like I have no doubt that compared to other people there, you are like way more advanced in terms of like being able to get up on stage and talk in front of a group. And you are way more advanced in terms of... being able to be funny, and you are way more advanced, like probably in a million different ways. And at the same time, in terms of the skill that I think is the skill that's the really, really interesting skill about improv, which is like to be able to lose yourself in a collaboration with someone else, I don't think there is evidence that you're more advanced in that. And all the thinking about how good you are at the other stuff, like it actually makes you like worse at the part that I think is what improv is supposed to teach. You're actually worse at collaborating than most people in the class.
Yeah.
So you're actually not an expert. You're actually like a remedial student. Like if you're trying to do a beginner's class that's about collaboration, you shouldn't even be thinking about performance and being funny and all that stuff. And if the very first exercise you do is basically have them reenact a moment of someone standing up in front of a stage while people clap for them, you're like kind of reconstructing the very structures that seem to me to be the structures that you want to be undoing.
So I went back to improv. And I'm not sure if it was something that Misha said. It was definitely something that Misha said. But it didn't feel draining in the same way. Could have also been the fact that we'd worked through all the kooky break out of your shell stuff. We were actually playing a game that wasn't about being funny at all. Here's how it worked. You stand across from another person at one end of the room. I was paired with... let's call her Anita.
Smallish, shy, prone to overthinking her contributions and getting mixed up.
So one person says a very mundane thing to the other person. Something that they might actually say in real life. And then the other person has to respond with something that starts with yes and. And then you build on that, and so on. Anita was standing there, and she was wearing this drapey pastel sweater thing. And she looked like she was kind of shrinking into it. And even though we didn't really vibe as people, like, she was the one who said she loved Israel earlier, I decided to really go for it.
Beverly, you're my sister. I love you, but this pie is burnt.
Yes, and it's still better than the pie you baked on Thanksgiving.
Yes, and that pie was loved by everyone, so.
Yes, and it was way too sweet.
Yes, and maybe you have problems with sweets.
Yes, and maybe you don't take care of your sugar intake.
Yes, and I'm looking fine, so.
Yes, and maybe you have diabetes now.
Yes, and I need to crash your place if that's the case.
Yes, and you're my sister, and I love you.
Yes.
People were clapping, and they didn't have to. She gave me this "we did that" kind of look. It felt really good. I realized that a big part of doing improv is something pretty basic that I do badly at least a few times a day. It's about listening. Like, when someone is talking to you, it's about actually taking in what they're saying and responding in a way that takes something further, instead of sidestepping it. And that feels like something worth working on. So maybe I was humbled. But what happens when you take "yes and" out of the classroom?
Like, right. I use a lot of the things I know from, like, theater and stuff.
Yeah, actually, she's hot, right?
No. Okay.
Wait, it's a compliment.
She's hot.
It's a compliment.
On the next episode, something happens at the bar after class that makes me consider the unintended consequences of affirmation. And then I go deeper with Becky, Ann, Alia, and Kayla to hear about how real-world power dynamics play out on stage.
Like, your response, if not physically, then even verbally, is to want to, like, attack and be on the offensive. But that's something that we learn as women very early on in comedy, is like, never lose that, like, that thing in you that makes you want to scream with a knife.
And I was like the registrar, and at one point I was like, you know what, yeah, like, we have quotas. And the audience went, oh. And what I was thinking in my mind, I was thinking intelligence level, and of course the audience all saw a white woman saying that to a black man.
There is like a deep old pain in me that just wants to crush them with jokes and smother them until they're done.
That was Alia Rasool, Anne Pornell, Becky Johnson, and Kayla Lorette, who love a good game of Kunja. You also heard from Misha Globerman, who is a mythological character hanging from the rafters of Harvard, and Chris Locke, who loves the sun. You can read more about their lives outside of this episode at canadalandshow.com/imp. I produced this episode of The Imposter with Ali Graham and Angela Shackle. Our theme music is by Nathan Burley. Special thanks to Kate Bars from the Trampoline Hall podcast, and to Callum Wilkin-Gillies and Andrew Johnston from the Laugh Sabbath Comedy Collective, who do shows at Comedy Bar every month. Follow us on Twitter at Imster, that's IMPSTR, and you can follow me at Aaliyah Pabani. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/candleland, and if you like The Imposter, tell your friends that The Imposter is this generation's This American Life.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.